Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Pluxcast. We have a very distinguished and venerable guest with us today, Mr. Garvin Walsh, who is an internet celebrity and general all-round celebrity. Garvin, why don't you introduce yourself?
I like this idea of being venerable. It's particularly pleasant because I'm going to turn 42 next week. So the level of venerability is about to increase a notch. So I was once Tory foreign policy advisor, went over to academia for a while, came back into politics because somebody made the mistake of winning the 2015 election, which meant that we obviously then had to give the referendum to the, what were they called? Fruitcakes, loons and closet racists in UKIP that had infiltrated the Conservative Party. And we then went on to lose that referendum, the upshot of which is I'm over here in the former imperial capital, no longer the UK as its member.
I like that. Less than a minute in and we're already talking about Brexit. It's the way it should be.
It's the way it should be, the way of the world. But you wear quite a few hats, do a few different roles here in Brussels. So
yeah, one of the ones at the moment is I'm a visiting fellow at the Wilfred Martin Centre, which is the EPP's think tank. I'm looking at defence policy, particularly defence industrial policy. The big question of the week and of the month and of the year is, of course, how do we get enough ammunition to Ukraine? The Ukrainian armed forces at the beginning of the war were using as much ammunition in a week as the British army has in its entire stocks. And I'm sure that's true of the French army, the Italian army, and let's probably not talk about the German army.
Quite. But how's that discussion going with the European institutions? Does the Commission, did the Council understand the need to have almost military-industrial policy to solve these problems, to close that gap?
They're starting to understand that, but we have to do this in a much more creative way because, thanks not least to the assiduous efforts of my former employers in the Conservative Party, the EU treaties don't allow direct spending on defence. So they found ways around it with the European Defence Fund, which is an economic competitiveness fund that happens to deal with this aspect of technology that is highly related to defence. There's things like the European Defence Industrial Production Act, and there are other things that can be done. So we can think about how to really build a European DARPA. We can think about how to provide guarantees for the financing of defence equipment by member states at European rates of debt rather than their own domestic rates of debt. We may be able to use some of the own resources decision to access some of that funding. Perhaps it'll be quite a technical legal argument to see if we can get that one over the line. We can also look at the what are called the shared management funds. The famous one of these is the Cohesion Fund, but there are others. And because the last budget was decided in 2019, there was a lot of stuff about migration and health. Had the budget been decided in 2021, I suspect there'd been a lot of stuff that I can't believe is not defence going into that.
Hey, just a quick interruption. Pluxcast is now sponsored by eurobrussels.com.
Eurobrussels is the leading online resource for job postings and career development here in the capital of the EU.
And if you want to find a job, or even if you just want to see the job postings, there really is no better place to go.
So many thanks to Lars and the Eurobrussels team for supporting us over the next 10 episodes.
So let's look at how we can equalise defence R&D across the Union. It's still very heavily concentrated in the wealthier member states, which, you know, you kind of expect. And, you know, the French and the Italians and the Nordics all make great technology. But there's a lot of scientific talent in the former Soviet satellite states in Central Europe that could be used, and a lot of people there who feel very threatened by Russian expansionism and want to put that knowledge to work. So I think the EU should help them, and there should be a way of harnessing Polish and Estonian and Bulgarian technical knowledge and skills for the next generation of defence R&D in Europe. So it's great that France is doing lots of R&D. It's great that Macron has plan to increase the French defence budget by, I think, a factor of 2 over the next 10 years. But as long as France is deciding what's bought because it has the money, slightly the wrong things will get bought from the point of view of Poland and Estonia. Because France has other defence needs in the Mediterranean, in the Sahel, even in the Pacific, where New Caledonia is a surprisingly large French territory. But the needs that Estonia will have, the needs that other countries will have, are quite different. I mean, air forces are quite a good example here. The Western model of air forces is to establish air superiority. That means we go in, we put most of our firepower in very heavy fighters and bombers. We destroy their air defence. We establish air superiority. And our military theory is that once we do that, we can then basically destroy their targets at will. Now, we've never actually tried this in a full-scale war against a peer or near-peer adversary. We wouldn't know how, if there were to be a NATO-Russia conflict, we wouldn't quite know how that would work. But we do know that Ukraine is fighting against a country that doesn't quite impose its own air superiority against them, but it's certainly true that Ukraine doesn't have air superiority against Russia. And the only country that has a similar kind of doctrine is actually Sweden. They were neutral, they realized they had to defend themselves against Russia, but also knew that if they did, there's no way they'd be able to control their own airspace. They'd have to have jets that could pop up, land quickly, be serviced in a modular fashion by small crews, so that they couldn't be taken out by the Russian Air Force. So they developed the Gripen. It's probably the plane that is best used for Ukraine, but it's not the kind of plane that the big future-looking European defense procurement programs are thinking about. There are two non-American Western future defense programs, both confusingly called the Future Combat Air System, because I think they lack originality. But one is French, Spanish, and German, I think, and the other one is British, Italian, and Japanese. Mm-hmm. They're all about a replacement for the Eurofighter Typhoons, a big, all singing, all dancing, amazing plane. But the assumption there is that we have a secure base from which to operate those planes. But certain countries might not have that secure base. Would Estonia have that secure base? Probably not. They'd have to have a kind of a guerrilla air war. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Swedish Gripen was designed for that. But not many of those are being procured. This is partly Sweden's relatively small diplomatic heft because it's a relatively small country. But there's, you know, a few hundred Gripens in the world. They'd be very good for a country, particularly for a country like Ukraine, to be able to mount its own defense without necessarily having NATO intervention. Whereas the F-16, which is the other candidate for supplying Ukraine, because there's a lot of them available, again, very effective plane, very, very capable, but it does need much heavier infrastructure to support it, and that heavier infrastructure is then a target. Yeah. So there's a balance. Do you supply them with a very large number of these F-16s, but know quite a lot of them, and their infrastructure will be easily destroyed by the Russians because of the circumstance which they have to fight? Or do you use something that's more, in the jargon, survival?
I think particularly in light of Zelensky's tour of Western capitals last week and sort of that message that he wants the West to give planes. Is that nuance understood by the people you're speaking to?
Yeah,
that there's a certain type of aircraft that works? Or is it just the public thinks, well, just give them F-16s?
Well, I mean,
that's what we see.
The Ukrainians will benefit from any aircraft, you know, but there's some that may be more useful for them than others. F-16s are better than nothing. Gripens are better than nothing. You know, F-35s would be brilliant, but there are logistical problems, never mind diplomatic ones, about introducing F-35s into that kind of theatre.
And so when you are advocating for Ukraine or these arms for Ukraine, how is that received amongst European audiences and European decision makers?
I think there's three blocks in European sort of thinking now. There's a block of Nordics plus Baltics who think they're under existential threat from Russia and want to do everything they can to support the Ukrainians because they realize Ukrainians are fighting the war that they would have to fight themselves. There are some people who just, you know, hope it would go away and go back to business as usual. They tend to emerge every few months and go quiet after the Russians commit some other atrocity. But they're still there, they're still coming back. Berlusconi was the most recent one, complaining about stuff. But other more serious figures can come up from time to time. They're often in the German SPD, they're in Podemos in Spain. You see a lot of outside Europe, a lot of these people, like Lula, coming back and saying, well, you know, let's just be even-handed between the aggressor and the victim.
Coming back to sort of the focus of Pluxcast on how things work here at Brussels, do you think think tanks are uniquely positioned to make those kind of arguments that you're making? So, you know, in the Brussels debate, we have the NGO community, we've got the institutions, we've got the corporates. But think tanks, do you have that space to do that thinking, come up with those ideas in a bit more of a sort of reasoned atmosphere? So in corporate lobbying, it's pretty much firefighting, it's issue to issue, day to day, and we're rushing around. But in the think tank world, I guess you have a bit more space and a little bit less pressure to do that thinking. So is that the case? And is the value of that recognised by
I mean, the value of the think tank world is that we can look at what actually might work. We can come up with detailed policies and do the work. Because what happens is the politicians find they've got a news cycle to beat and they need some ideas. And it's our responsibility. especially as a party-affiliated think tank, it's our responsibility to have stuff they can pick up and run with and will actually be effective, you know, within the confines of that party's positioning and ideology, and that they don't come up with rubbish. And we have the space and think tanks to provide that kind of thinking for our side to be able to have good policies. The same with rival think tanks. I mean, friendly rivals. I mean, it's good that they come up with good policies too, because then the quality of the debate and the quality of the solutions is higher, especially in a consensus-oriented parliament like the European Parliament, where you have to always negotiate with all the groups. So it's a better thing when the groups all produce better policies.
Do you find that the policymakers are coming to you proactively to have those ideas generated, or is it vice versa, that you're generating the ideas in the papers and then pitching them into the party or into the parliament or commission?
It's more a case that we generate the ideas and then they, the actual politicians, need to react to some event. So you think of us as producing the ammunition, and the politicians and the commission being the actual fighter planes and the artillery pieces, to extend the previous conversation. You know, the ammunition needs to be there for them to use in their political debates and their policy making. And if it's not there, they'll just be forced to improvise. And when they're forced to improvise, you often end up with poorly thought out things that don't work.
So if you are, if we know we're thinking as professionals and considering logistics, not tactics, how do you logistically get that ammunition to the policymakers? Would you use political adverts, or is it all in the face-to-face conversation?
It's usually face-to-face conversations, it's seminars, it's retreats, it's discussions, it's panel discussions, it's meetings. You wouldn't use that, because think tanks, at least this kind of think tank, isn't really in the pressure game. A different think tank might be, you know. So if you're a non-party affiliated think tank, you might want to use political advertising or other marketing techniques to raise awareness of something. Then you might go slightly more into the NGO style of advocacy. But as a party affiliated think tank, you pretty much have an inside channel. That's what you're for. Mm. So you use those inside channels, and that allows the politicians you work with to take the credit, which is, after all, what they like doing.
Of course they do. And do you think, is there sufficient transparency in the think tank world? So you say that Wilfred Martens isn't a pressure think tank, but there are some think tanks that are there to advocate positions or to pressure policymakers. Is the funding structure transparent? Is the way they operate transparent? Is it, or is there more that needs to be done? So, you know, should think tankers be also on the register of lobbyists to provide that additional transparency?
Our funding in the Martens Center is heavily transparent, very audited. If anything, the rules are too complicated. So the European Parliament provides these party foundations with money and then provides them with an awful lot of rules that mean we can't actually spend that money. Sometimes we're in a bit of a Brewster's Millions type situation. I'll give you an example. We're not allowed to cooperate with state-funded organisations. You think, you know, fair enough, you know, you shouldn't be going off and, you know, working with a joint paper with some EU government because your party happens to be in power there.
Sure.
I get that. On the other hand, it causes problems collaborating with universities, because in many EU member states, universities happen to mostly be state-funded.
Hmm.
So great, we can cooperate with the private universities, but we want to have a wider range of partners, and there shouldn't, you know, these rules need to be drafted a bit more carefully. The intention's good, but the execution's often too detailed and doesn't really understand the end user, which might be a wider lesson.
Yeah, that's true of many rules.
So I just want to go back. I want to challenge you a second, because you said that it's not a pressure think tank, but thinking of your lobbying for Ukraine, you have a lot of national positions, you have a lot of different opinions amongst the EPP, and part of what you're doing is taking this pro-Ukraine standpoint and bringing it to the politicians. What is that, if not pressure?
Well, I think the EPP is actually very united on Ukraine.
Well, Silvio.
Silvio, but Tajani, for example, who's the Italian foreign minister, same party, is very much in line with the same thing. I mean, Silvio himself has quite a mouth. But generally speaking, the EPP is one of the more united groups on this. But if we would take a group that might not be as united, like the Greens, where you've got the German Greens, who have a very clear pro-Ukrainian position, and other Green parties that might still adhere to their traditional pacifism. So there'd be a advocacy job. I would say that the party think tanks tend to operate mostly within the consensus that the party think tank has already established. Mm-hmm. They can obviously have ideas that push the envelope a bit, try and be a bit creative, but they don't generally come up with stuff that would be totally crazy from that party's point of view. They're not there to sort of move the Overton window radically or use shock tactics. It's just not their institutional structure or their governance or anything like that. Yeah. That's why they're often, you know, they're serious technocratic bodies rather than, hey, here's a, you know, really radical idea. Why don't you do that? They don't operate like the, you know, the modern IEA does in Britain.
Does Wilfred Rodin have almost a monopoly on the think tank space within the EPP, or you compete? Are there other think tanks that are trying to sort of also?
Well, what we try and do is work with political party foundations of our member parties. So, obviously the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung is a big one, but you know the Fine Gael has the Michael Collins Institute. Our member parties in the Czech Republic have their own institutes, and in Austria, and so we want to try and foster and build an ecosystem throughout the party group of different think tanks in the member states as well as at a European level, so that we can deepen the quality of policymaking in our political family across the continent. You know, there are some countries like Germany where it's a really deeply established tradition. There are other countries where it's much thinner. And that does depend, obviously, on the way the local political culture works out, how much state funding political foundations get. You know, in Ireland, it's basically nil. Mm-hmm. In Germany, it's a lot. They did this deliberately after the war to try and give some stability to German politics so that you didn't have to be constantly chasing individual, you know, fashionable things of the day in order to survive as a political party or to have that thought. They even the funding formula in Germany doesn't just reflect the result of the last election, but it's kind of an exponential average of the last few elections.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, for example, even though the CDU lost quite a few seats, they didn't quite lose as much funding because the idea is you don't want it to be too responsive to the individual changes in the election results. You want it to be responsive over time.
Okay.
So, you know, gradually the Green foundations are getting more money, but it's not like a sudden rush that they don't know what to do with yet either. You know, they want to, the idea is to kind of, you know, temper the swings of the political spectrum. It's not like in the UK where the party that's doing well suddenly gets loads of cash.
So you've sort of explained some of the work that you're doing around Ukraine and defense policy, but what are some of the other areas you're looking at? I know you have an interest in tech regulation, how that's playing out, and some views on the success or not of that discussion in Brussels at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there was a while when nobody sort of paid much attention on tech regulation. It just happened. Then there were a whole series of scandals, starting with Cambridge Analytica onwards. And you've got a body that didn't have much tech expertise. You've got a body with recruitment processes that deter anyone who'd be able to get a job in the tech industry from working for them, because you have to do such mind-numbingly boring aptitude tests to even get considered for a new position. Why would you do that when you might do equally mind-numbingly boring aptitude tests for a Google engineering position, but they're only going to take a couple of hours and you'll know within a week or two whether you'll get the job? Just if you have those options, you're really unlikely to apply for the commission. They've been trying to expand it, and they've brought in more people working on digital policy, but they've had to run to catch up. Not so much an overreaction, it's a badly targeted reaction to a lot of the problems that tech industry is doing. The AI Act is an example, the political ads transparency regulation. These have certain, you know, problems. The original draft of the AI Act wanted to classify almost everything as general purpose AI and have it risk assessed. There's a product liability directive that is so badly drafted it could risk the future of open source software and innovation in Europe, because it imposes really heavy compliance costs on what are often like two or three person projects, who, because of the amazing reproducibility of software, can achieve things that two or three people couldn't in other industries. So you just, and have to have these teams have a big compliance department, would kill all that innovation. This is the kind of thing where they could deal with it by just sticking out, you know, a threshold. So the problem at the moment is that if you monetize your open source project at all, which you usually do by tech support or some other means, you then have to have the compliance obligation. And that really should kick in only when it's above a certain size. Because you do, if you've got a widely used product, yes, you probably do want to make sure that it's patched for security holes, that it works in a wide variety of circumstances and so forth. But that really should only be done when the organization sustaining that product is actually big enough. If you do visuals for this, there's a great XKCD cartoon of internet infrastructure where you've got, it's like this massive Jenga tower, and then there's like a really thin bit and a man like typing in at a computer, and it just says, this is all the world's infrastructure, it depends on this, maintained by one guy in Nebraska.
That point you raised about the commission not necessarily attracting the people with the full knowledge of a subject area, it's not really the commission's fault, is it, when you've got a civil service the size of Kent County Council, and they're having their budget reduced every year.
Well, it is the commission's fault because their recruitment procedures don't make sense.
Yeah, but they don't have the budget, they don't have the funding. The council's cut their budget at every opportunity for like the last 20 years.
But it's not that they don't have the right people, it's that their processes can't recruit them because they take too long.
Okay, well, so the point I was trying to make...
That's a separate point. They're cutting the budget, that's a separate point. I mean,
okay.
It's valid from the commission's point of view, it's just a different one.
Okay, fair enough. But it doesn't necessarily reflect itself in an advantage to, say, big tech or anything like that. Because if you look at some of their lobbying, if you look at some of how the way they bring their messages to the fore, it's not very good, is it? It's not been the most effective, and you would expect, if they're attracting the best people, for them to be blowing everyone out of the water. But you look at the Data Act, you look at the AI Act, they haven't had the sweeping victories that you would expect. Why is that?
Partly because they've made themselves, you know, unpopular through their own kind of monopolistic behaviour. So they should be expecting a kind of reaction. And if they were well-organised, intelligent lobbyists, they'd work out how to, you know, try and mitigate the costs of that. And maybe also there's a bit of a dialogue of the deaf in that these processes seem to happen between comms teams that don't know about technology and regulatory teams that don't know about technology either. They probably need more engineering expertise on both sides so they can have a sensible conversation about what's actually going on. You see a lot of very glitzy stuff like, you know, I don't know, the metaverse or whatever nonsense it is this week. You saw the mad Ponzi scheme that lasted 10 years that was blockchain. Never had any purpose. But somehow loads of people talked about it because loads of people in business as well as the commission also have no idea about technology. And they couldn't understand that there was nothing blockchain did that other technologies didn't already do in the first place.
Is this sort of gap caused by the lack of knowledge of people in the institutions, or is it also more of a cultural thing, so a risk aversion philosophy that
we have
in Europe?
It's risk aversion that comes from the lack of knowledge, because if you did understand how these things work in more detail, you could mitigate the risks more intelligently. You could say, well, if you look at the council drafts of the AI Act, they have much more sense, probably informed by member states that have reasonable tech industries. They have a much more reasonable understanding of, yes, there are risks about using AI algorithms which are horrifically inexact to decide who the police should search or decide who gets what job. And of course, these need to be tested and regulated and maybe forbidden in certain cases. But it doesn't mean you try and include all general purpose AI in this thing. You have to include particular kinds of techniques. By the way, you know, the biggest risk of a lot of this AI is not that it's going to take over the world with amazing killer robots. It's that it's rubbish.
Not a fan of ChatGPT then, guy.
Or even, I think ChatGPT is both an amazing achievement and a limited one. So it's amazing in that we've basically created David Cameron in robotic form. A fluent machine that spouts total bullshit. surprisingly efficiently and quickly and open to lots of people. But it doesn't know anything. The technical term for this is hallucinate. So they just make stuff up because they know how words relate to each other, but they don't really know what anything means. So everything's just a statistical guess. But ChatGPT just makes stuff up, which is embarrassing. There have been some experiments with Bing's chatbot, which seems to turn up turn into like an emotionally abusive psychopath. So if ChatGPT is David Cameron, Bing seems to be Donald Trump. I am right. How dare you suggest this? I know this is true. You're attacking me. Like, some of the stuff that researchers have managed to get out of Bing's beta is quite something, because it really gets upset if you accuse it of being wrong.
It's like a politician. It's exactly like a politician.
You said that AIs weren't going to take over the world, but that sounds like an AI who will.
Touché. But it won't know where its power cable is. So
exactly.
Unplug it, yeah.
And on that note, we are coming up to the half an hour mark. So Gavin, how do we follow you? Are you writing any books? Are you have anything to plug?
I can plug my column on Conservative Home, which
great article today.
Yeah, and good article this morning. Yeah, everybody go and have a read.
All about Ukraine and how they're fighting our war, and we need to support them. We need to give them the tools to finish the job, as someone once said. I sometimes write for Foreign Policy.
And you're on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter, as long as Twitter survives. I really quite worried they're going to run out of money. Considering all the desperate attempts like charging for API access, it's going to piss a lot of people off and not going to get that much money.
No.
In. It's not an unreasonable fee, like $100 a month. It's just if they're trying to scrape that bit of the barrel, they're in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, and spending all their money on boosting Elon's posts to the
disbenefit
of everybody
else.
That's
fair enough. It's Elon's own company, so in that's a rational use of resources for Mr. Musk. But at some point, he's going to run out of those resources.
Mm-hmm. As a blue tick subscriber, I'm quite happy with it. Long live Elon Musk and Slava Ukraine.